This week we'll look at the Turkish invasion of Syria and learn what it means prophetically. Who or what is the power behind Islam? But first, more on the fulfillment of Jeremiah 51:46. Week, the Democrats and members of Obama's former administration just increased their threats against President Donald Trump. Stay tuned. I'll be right back. Thank you for joining me for today's Beastwatch News Update. News from the Internet's most comprehensive Bible prophecy news website, BeastWatchNews.com. I'm Kimberly Rogers Brown. The New York Post reported this week that credible reports suggest there is a massive scandal involving the top ranks of America's premier law enforcement agency that are coming forward now, and the wagons of protection are being circled around the FBI. The reports, which feature talk among agents of a secret society and suddenly missing text messages, point to the existence both of a cabal dedicated to defeating Donald Trump in 2016 and of a plan to let Hillary Clinton skate free in the classified email probe. If either one is true, and the writer of this article, Michael Goodwin, says both probably are, it would mean the FBI leaders betrayed the nation by abusing their powers in a bid to pick the president. More support for this view involves the FBI's use of the Russian dossier on Trump that was paid for by the Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee. It is almost certain that the FBI used the dossier to get FISA court warrants to spy on Trump associates, meaning it used the opposition research of the party in power to convince a court to let it spy on the candidate of the other party, likely without telling the court of the dossier's political link. Even worse, there is growing reason to believe someone in President Barack Obama's administration turned over classified information about Trump to the Clinton campaign. These and other elements combine to make a toxic brew that smells to high heaven. But most Americans don't know about the prophecy of Jeremiah 51:46, that came directly from heaven, nor do they know much about the details of the scandal, or that it may possibly be a fulfillment of that obscure prophecy about end times Babylon. Mainstream media coverage has been sparse and dismissive, and there's a blackout from the same Democrats obsessed with Russia. Russia, Russia. Partisan motives aside, it's as if a scandal of this magnitude is more than American bear. So, let's pretend there's nothing to see and just move along. Well, I believe the magnitude of the scandal, along with the fact that it is about a former administration attacking a current one, are the factors that make this a fulfillment of Jeremiah 51:46. This verse has to do with two leaders that fight each other, one attacking and one defending. Given the ancient context when former kings would not have been alive during the reign of a current king. You know, kings died before they were succeeded on their thrones. That scripture indicates another form of government rather than monarchy, a government where former rulers would still be alive when the current one is ruling. This indicates an elective government, the kind of government that did not exist at the time of Jeremiah, and is a huge clue to us that America is end times Babylon. Investigation of this scandal won't disappear anytime soon, and hopefully the truth will come out thanks to a handful of congressional Republicans led by California Representative Devin Nunes, chairman of the House's Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. After he accused the FBI of stonewalling and turning over records, the Bureau relented, at least partially. The result was clear evidence of bias against Trump by officials charged with investigating him and Clinton. Those same agents appear to have acted on that bias to tilt the election to Clinton. In one text message, an agent suggests that Attorney General Loretta Lynch knew while the investigation was still going on that the FBI would not recommend charges against Clinton. How could she know unless the fix was in? All roads in the explosive developments lead to James Comey, whose Boy Scout image belied a sinister belief that he, like his infamous predecessor J. Edgar Hoover, was above the law. It is why Michael Goodwin named him J. Edgar Comey last year and wrote that he was adept at using innuendo and leaks to let everybody in Washington know they could be the next to be investigated. It was in the office of Comey's top deputy, Andrew McCabe, where agents discussed an insurance policy in the event that Trump won. Reports indicated that the Russia collusion probe was that insurance policy. This is why the Jeremiah 51:46 prophecy said the war between the two rulers would cover 2 years. It has taken a year for the truth of this scandal to be uncovered and will take another year or longer for more of the truth to come out. The text to Attorney General Loretta Lynch was from Peter Stroke, the top investigator on the Trump case, and was sent to Lisa Page, an FBI lawyer, and also Stroke's mistress. I want to believe the path you threw out for consideration in Andy's office, that there's no way he gets elected, but I'm afraid we can't take that risk. It's like an insurance policy in the unlikely event you die before you're 40, Stroke wrote, quote unquote. It is frightening that Stroke, who called Trump an idiot, was the lead investigator on both the Clinton and Trump cases. Now, we're going to listen to what Judge Jeanine Pirro has had to say about the government shutdown, because this government shutdown is just another of the Democrats' stroke to kill off the Trump administration.
1 year ago, he promised he would prioritize the American people.
From this day forward, it's going to be only America first.
And they promised they would obstruct and resist everything he did. Both have been true to their word. So here we are, 1 year from the inauguration of America's 45th president, and a minority of Democrat senators take advantage of this day to shut the government down, holding the American people hostage, hundreds of millions of Americans, military families, and sick children, choosing to prioritize and protect 700,000 DACA recipients who aren't even citizens. And to show you how mean-spirited the Democrats are, they are shutting the government down over a bill that has nothing in it that they oppose. Obstruction is their mission, pure and simple. Make no mistake, this is about stepping on President Trump's 1 year anniversary and his opportunity to highlight to America his accomplishments. Come on, folks. The Democrats are gaming you.
Judge Pirro was right. The government shutdown ended early on January 23rd. The Democrats just wanted to make their point, which is that they, under the leadership of Barack Obama, are in control of the United States. Jeremiah 51:46. All is not well in Babylon. Prosecutor Mueller is not giving up his vendetta, though. He began questioning President Trump's cabinet this week, starting with Attorney General Jeff Sessions. The saga will continue for a while, as the prof says. Not only are the Democrats acting against President Trump on the domestic front, the former Obama administration is thwarting Trump on foreign policy as well. John Kerry, Obama's former Secretary of State, is getting into the act of subverting Trump's efforts. According to a report in Israel's Maariv newspaper, John Kerry held a meeting with a confidant of Mahmoud Abbas named Hussein Agha, in which he encouraged the Palestinian leader to defy President Trump and his peacemaking efforts in the region. Abbas, Kerry said, should stay strong in his spirit and play for time. Kerry warned Abbas not to break or yield to President Trump's demands. Kerry reportedly gave Aga tips on how to interact with the Americans and asked that Abbas not attack the U.S. in general or the Trump administration, but to focus on attacking Trump personally. The report said that Kerry hinted to Aga that many in the American establishment are dissatisfied with Trump's actions and leadership. Kerry also reportedly communicated that he didn't expect the president to remain in office for much longer. However, there were no specifics given as to how Kerry thought this would come about. Ordinarily, the only reasons a president does not finish a term is due to incapacitation, resignation, or impeachment by Congress. None of these scenarios is currently in the offing. Let me stop reading from the article and tell you that there is another way to get a president out of office called assassination. The U.S. government used it against John F. Kennedy. However, assassinating Trump would leave Pence in office and others of Trump's cabinet to take the reins in such an event. So, unless the Democrats, under the advisement of Barack Obama, intends to fulfill the suggestion offered in the TV series Designated Survivor, where the entire White House staff is killed during the president's annual State of the Union address, we will have to wait and see what malicious strategy they will use. Now, back to the article. Kerry also suggested that the Palestinians put forward their own peace plan and promised that if they did, he would push it with all his might to everyone he knew to garner support for it in the international arena. He also mentioned that he was seriously considering running for president in 2020. When asked about his advanced age, he'd be 77, he said he was not much older than Trump now, which is 71, and would not have an age problem. Obama's attacks on President Trump are getting worse and probably won't stop for some time to come. Now let's take a look at Turkish invasion of Syria. The Turks invaded Syria last Sunday. This invasion is leaving the U.S. in a bind. The conflict taking place in Syria involves an American ally country who is a member of NATO and a militia group that the United States has partnered with as part of its war against ISIS. The NATO ally is Turkey, and the militia partner is the YPG, a Kurdish militia group that the U.S. engaged to help fight ISIS. The administration is hoping to end the fighting in Afrin, but is not yet willing to seriously pressure Turkey on the subject. Instead, Washington is encouraging all sides to focus on fighting ISIS. There is a 200-year-old prophecy of pre-messianic conflict between Russia and Turkey that was spoken by Rabbi Elijah ben Solomon Zalman, known as the Vilna Gaon, one of the greatest Jewish scholars of the 18th century, who was also a known Kabbalist or a mystic. Just before his death, the Vilna Gaon made a two-part prophecy that was kept secret, transferred orally from teacher to student for generations. This prophecy became public for the first time in 2014 by Rabbi Moshe Sternbuch, a great-grandson of the Vilna Gaon. The prophet said, "When you hear that the Russians have captured the city of Crimea, you should know that the times of the Messiah have started, that his steps are being heard. And when you hear that the Russians have reached the city of Constantinople, you should put on your Shabbat clothes and don't take them off, because it means that the Messiah is about to come any minute." The first part of the prophecy appeared to materialize in 2014 when Russia invaded Ukraine and annexed Crimea. The second half of the prophecy concerning a conflict between Russia and Turkey is one of many possible outcomes of the current escalation in Syria. Turkey is a member of the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance, that's NATO, and traditionally is an ally of the U.S. Russia has permanent military base Syria, supporting the regime of Syrian President Bashar Bashar al-Assad in the civil war against rebel forces, which include ISIS. Russia has also, with the YPK in the past in the fight against ISIS, which would pit Russia against Turkey should that superpower choose to stand up for its sometimes ally. The pitting of Russia against Turkey could play into Iran's role as King of the North when this king hears of trouble from the North, Daniel 11:44. It may be that both Iran and Russia, who are the same ancient Persian people, will coordinate the global war effort beginning with Turkey. Ostensibly, the Iranians and Russians together actually constitute the King of the North. Iran will go to war in the world's religious realm, while Russia will make war on the more secular nations. There could be overlap. For instance, while Iran is conquering the southern Middle East, Russia may open a war front directly with the United States. The war fronts of the two nations, Iran and Russia, remain to be seen, but it makes more sense that the eastern Russian superpower will take on the western U.S. superpower than that Iran would take on U.S. This alliance between Russia and Syria is consistent with a later addendum to the Vilna Gaon's prophecy, quoting, "The Russians will come, they will come and be together with the sons of Ishmael," unquote, the Kloisenberger rabbi added. The Arab peoples of today are primarily identified to be the spiritual descendants of Ishmael, according to Judaism, but the rabbis also call Ishmael the face of Islam, suggesting that there is something else behind Ishmael's mask. Back to what's happening in Syria, the U.S. has stepped up training of its border forces in Syria in the wake of Turkey's invasion. Does this mean the U.S. will take a shot at Turkey? That remains to be seen. Now, let's take a look at what lies behind the face of Ishmael. Let's uncover Ishmael's mask. The question of who founded Islam does not have an easy cut and dried black and white answer. Most believe the Ishmaelites are the founders of Islam, but that is too simple an answer. Islam is an end times answer to an ancient dispute found in the book of Genesis. We must pull back the covers to see who, in the end of days, is the aggressor and who is the victim. The one with the aggressive and violent agenda is likely the one who founded Islam. The others who are with this aggressor are only participants. The patriarch of Israel, Jacob, has an enemy who has wanted to kill him from the beginning. Jacob's enemy in the beginning will be the same enemy in the end. How can we be sure of this premise? God says he tells us the end in the beginning, Isaiah 40:10. In other words, the repeating patterns of history were set by God in the beginning so that believers will understand what is happening in the end of days. Taking a look at the enemies of Jacob requires us to know who Jacob's descendants are in the end of days, because these will also be subject to the violent hand of the enemy. For the most part, his descendants are Jews and Christians. However, there are millions of Muslims who were converted from Judaism and Christianity. These will be called back into the faith of Yahweh when the time comes, and we can expect the enemy of the Jews and Christians to perpetrate violence against these Muslims too. There are two candidates for founder of Islam, Esau and Ishmael. We will examine both. First, let's learn about Esau. Esau was Jacob's twin and archenemy in the beginning. The final struggle between Esau and Jacob will come almost 4,000 years later during the time known as Jacob's Trouble, also called the Great Tribulation. Let's review the facts in the beginning to discover what will happen in the end of days. It was Esau who tried to kill Jacob in the womb, Genesis 25:22, while exiting Rebekah's womb, Genesis 25:26, during Jacob's lifetime, Genesis 27 verses 42 to 45, and Esau prophesied that one day, eventually, he would kill Jacob, Genesis 33 verse 4, where the kiss of Esau is prophesied in the Torah scroll as a jot that looks like teeth, a bite mark. These are all attempted murder that failed, but Esau is not done. God wants us to know and understand Jacob's enemy, who is also our enemy. There is a principle that says the things that happened to the patriarchs and the early generation will happen to us in the end of days. Therefore, it behooves us to pay attention to the clues God gives us to know our enemy. God's first clue to us for the end of days has to do with Esau's physical appearance. He was a red man. Genesis 25:25, and God tells us to always remember that Esau was red, and that Edom, Esau's territory, was red too. Genesis 25:30. In the end of days, the color red will figure prominently in particular cultures, governments, religions, and belief system. Esau also was hairy. Genesis 27:11, and a man of the field, Genesis 25:7. Esau was as a beast, an animal, more interested in satisfying his lust than anything else. He was a man with no interest in learning or obeying Torah or in having a relationship with God. He rejected God and God's instructions. Another characteristic of Esau is that he hides in order to strike. Hunting animals was Esau's primary passion, but he began to hunt humans, like his cousin King Nimrod, Genesis 10:9. In fact, it was Nimrod that Esau hunted. The book of Jasher tells the story of how Esau was hunting when he came across four other hunters. The hunting party was King Nimrod and three of his friends. Esau hid in the bushes, according to Jasher chapter 7, then sprang forth and beheaded King Nimrod. Afraid that the other men would come after him, he ran from the scene like a coward to get back home, where he traded red lentil stew, Genesis 5:30, for his birthright. Esau tipped his hand about his attitude toward his place as the firstborn during the red lentil stew incident. The scenario was that Jacob was cooking the stew of consolation for his father Isaac. Abraham had just died, and it was the eldest son's duty to console his father when the grandfather died. Esau, of course, was more interested in hunting than being a good and godly son, so he had gone to the field where he spied Nimrod and his men also hunt. After Esau killed Nimrod, came the father of beheading, he ran to his younger brother, who was performing the role of firstborn that Esau should have filled. Believing Nimrod's three men would find him and kill him, he turned his birthright over to the only other man who was qualified and who could be his successor, Jacob. Esau did not want the birthright because with that came required responsibilities. However, he wanted the wealth and power that comes with the blessing that goes with the birthright, which he would have used to satisfy his own lusts rather than taking care of the family. Esau later lost the blessing to Jacob, and he hated Jacob because of it. Genesis 7:1. Esau has been trying to get the blessing back ever since. We see from these accounts that another of Esau's characteristics is that of a bully. Bullies are usually cowards who hide, destroy, then run. Esau ran from Nimrod's men, then sold his birthright to Jacob and lost his blessing to him as well. Here is another example of Esau's bullying, the sudden attack. The Amalekites struck the Israelites with a battle when they were at their weakest during the Exodus. Later, the Edomites would not let the Israelites pass through their Edomite territory or give them water. Esau's lust for wealth and power and desire to kill Jacob's descendants are prevalent in his unwillingness to share resources. If hiding is Esau's modus operandi, then where has he hid himself for the last 4,000 years? The visions of the four beasts God gave to Daniel shows us one place where Esau has been. Those visions are warnings about the various ways that the Edomites, Esau's descendants, were coming to fulfill that prophetic bite on Jacob's neck back then, and how he will try to finish the job in the end of days. The book of Daniel explains the identities of the four beast governments and their leaders, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. Each of these empires were associated with Esau through his descendants. The first beast was Babylon, whose leader, Nebuchadnezzar, was an Edomite. Stay tuned, I'll be right back after these messages. Hi, this is Kimberly Rogers Brown, thanking you for listening to the Jerusalem Report, produced by BeastWatchNews.com, and asking you to send your support, a donation of any size, to BeastWatchNews.com. It costs money to run ministries, to teach the Word, interpret the prophecies, and to keep websites online. Trust me, we sure do appreciate it. And remember, you can read the transcript of today's broadcast under the Jerusalem Report at BeastWatchNews.com. Join me in Jerusalem for Passover 2018. I've put together an affordable tour of Israel and Jordan with three options. You can join us for 2 days, 7 days, or 13 days. Whatever fits your pocketbook. Go to BeastWatchNews.com for details, pricing, and to see the money you can save by coming on this tour. Let's all say, this year in Jerusalem! Here is another example of Esau's bullying, the sudden attack. The Amalekites struck the Israelites with a battle when they were at their weakest during the Exodus. Later, the Edomites would not let the Israelites pass through their Edomite territory or give them water. Esau's lust for wealth and power and desire to kill Jacob's descendants are prevalent in his unwillingness to share resources. If hiding is Esau's modus operandi, then where has he hid himself for the last 4,000 years? The visions of the four beasts God gave to Daniel shows us one place where Esau has been. Those visions are warnings about the various ways that the Edomites, Esau's descendants, were coming to fulfill that prophetic bite on Jacob's neck back then, and how he will try to finish the job in the end of days. The book of Daniel explains the identities of the four beast governments and their leaders, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. Each of these empires were associated with Esau through his descendants. The first beast was Babylon, whose leader, Nebuchadnezzar, was an Edomite. We know this from the account in Daniel 4:28-33, that Nebuchadnezzar became a true man of the field, living like a beast, eating grass like an animal, looking wild with long hair like an eagle's feathers and fingernails like a bird's talons. As a man of the field, he is connected to Esau, either physically, spiritually, or both. The next beast empire in the book of Daniel was Persia, Daniel 7:5. It is more difficult to see the Edomite beast in the Persian Empire, but it is there. Daniel had two visions of Persia. The first was that it is a bear, a beast with a bloodthirst. The Persian bear is raised up on one side because one side of it was stronger. The two sides in the past were Media and Persia. Those two sides today are Russia and Iran. The second Persian beast Daniel saw was a ram, Daniel 8:20. A ram is a clean animal and is associated with Israel and redemption. Esau is anything but clean, however, he is a Hebrew. The ram, in this context, represents Esau's identity as a Hebrew and a descendant of Shem. Esau is a Semite, who now appears as this Persian ram disguised as King Cyrus, who cared for Jerusalem like a shepherd. Esau, attempting to appear to be the firstborn son to the Jews. This ram is the face of a sheep over that of a bear's head, and it speaks of an ulterior motive in King Cyrus. He wanted Jerusalem, and rule over it he did, by making God's city beholden to him as a vassal city to the Persian Empire. Another and perhaps better association of Persia as an Edomite enclave is the entire account of Esther, where Haman, a descendant of Esau's grandson Amalek, was a prominent figure in the Persian government. It is doubtful that Haman was the only Edomite in the Persian government. Ancient Persia is modern Iran. Keep that in mind. The next beast empire of the book of Daniel is Greece, Daniel 8:5 and 21. This beast appears as a he-goat. Let's look at the Greek he-goat and how he is associated with Esau. The association begins with the Hebrew word sa'ir from Genesis 27:11, where the scripture says Esau was hairy. The masculine noun sa'ir denotes a he-goat, Leviticus 4:24. By association, it means shaggy goat. Why? A goat skin fooled Isaac into thinking Jacob was Esau. That word has other spellings and pronunciations, one of which is Seir, Mount Seir, the mountain given to Esau by God and where he migrated with his family. Genesis 36. The notable horn that Daniel saw on the shaggy he-goat is related to Mount Seir. Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau to the land of Seir, the country of Edom. Genesis 32 verse 3. An Edomite he-goat is exactly what Daniel saw in his vision. Yahweh did not want us to guess about the origins of Greece. You can find out more about this in my teachings, The Esau Effect and The Kingdom of Edom, The Enemy Face. The next beast empire Daniel saw was a beast that was unlike any natural animal on the earth. It had elements of beasts of the field, such as horns and claws, but it was more of a composite beast of war, whose horns were made of the material of war, iron, Daniel 7:7. This composite beast was Rome, but it was not just Rome, because Rome was an Edomite empire that later spawned Islam. Jewish historians nicknamed Rome Basra because it was well known that the Edomites had migrated to Rome from the Edomite capital, Basra, and had usurped the light-haired, light-eyed, and light-skinned indigenous Italian leadership there, just as they did when Esau migrated to Mount Seir and ousted the reigning Horite king by marrying his daughter, then going to war against him. Ancient Edomite Roman culture still persists in the modern world because of one element that Esau failed to use during his previous attempts to take back his birthright and world through Babylon, Persia, and Greece. That one element is religion. Esau finally figured out and made use of religion during the time of Rome to conquer and hold captive the house of Jacob, both Jews and lost 10 tribers, whom Esau could not conquer through war. He converted to his new religion, Christianity. But Christianity failed to subjugate all of Jacob's descendants, so the next religious thrust would be Islam. Look at the progression of Esau's attempts to eliminate Jacob. First, they took the Jews captive into Babylon, but capturing the Jews didn't make them disappear. So the Edomites' next attempt was to make Jerusalem a vassal city and send the Jews back to Jerusalem, where they would serve Esau under the guise of the Persian Empire. Isaac's blessing to Esau was that he would serve Jacob, but Esau was trying to make Jacob serve him. The Persians were not able to accomplish Esau's ultimate goal, so other Edomites from Greece stepped in. Unlike their Persian predecessors, the Greeks were not happy allowing the Jews to worship Yahweh in Jerusalem or having Jerusalem as merely a vassal city. After conquering their Persian brothers, the Greeks went to rule from Jerusalem. And also, unlike their Persian predecessors, the Greeks tried to convert the Jews away from the teachings of their father Jacob. Like Esau, the Greeks rejected Torah, and to make their point, they slaughtered a pig on Yahweh's holy altar to defile it. They removed circumcision, the sign of the Abrahamic covenant, from the Jews, and made it difficult for them to continue obeying the Torah. But the Jews would not convert to worshiping the Greek Edomite gods. Something more needed to be done, so along came Rome. Rome added the new religious tactic. Why did the Romans bring religion, forced conversion, into the situation? Military might had not worked in the three previous attempts to destroy Jacob, but the Edomites realized there was also another problem. They knew there were other tribes with a heritage right to Jerusalem. Rome could occupy and distress the Jews, even taking away what the Greeks had not, the temple. But they also needed to get rid of the other tribes, those which had gone into Assyrian captivity before the Babylonian captivity, and who were now scattered around the known world. So Rome created a religion to ensnare and encompass the Jews and the scattered lost tribes together under one theological rule. Rome's Christianity took advantage of the tension between the Jews and the Ger. The Ger were the converts who were returning to the Abrahamic covenant through belief in Yeshua as the Messiah. The Romans thwarted the reunification of the houses of Judah and Israel by using a twisted theology of a Messiah who rejected Torah like Esau. The lost tribes and Gentiles locked to Christianity because the house of Israel knew a Messiah was required to bring them back into the covenant. The Jews, on the other hand, rejected the Edomite lie. Jewish rejection of Christianity caused Rome to forcibly convert Jews into the new Edomite religion. Yet this also failed. Out of ignorance, Christians joined forces with Arabs to begin chasing Jews all over the earth. Esau has never completed his mission to either subjugate or kill all of Jacob's descendants. This is why another new religion was needed, one that concentrated on the final destruction of all of Jacob's descendants through a final war. It was why Rome instigated the creation of this religion, Islam. The Apostle Paul saw two more beasts arise, both of them from the same source. The first has already gone to war against the Jews and Christians once. The next Islamic empire will also go to war against the descendants of Jacob, both Jews and Christians, along with Muslims who don't belong to the next Islamic empire's particular sect. Now let's look at Ishmael. The Bible says Ishmael is a wild man and always contentious with his brothers, Genesis 6:12. But Ishmael is almost entirely lost in Scripture, unlike Esau's name, which is mentioned over three times more often. The sin of Ishmael is found in Genesis 21:9, when he did something bad to Isaac. Hagar and Ishmael were exiled for his behavior, and he will remain in exile until Messiah comes. But Ishmael's name doesn't come up again after Genesis until the book of Judges and the account of Gideon's battle, Judges 8:24. Ishmael was alluded to in the wanderings of the children of Israel when they traversed the wilderness of Zin, Numbers 20 verse 1, Ishmael's territory next to Edom. The genealogy of Ishmael appears in 1 Chronicles. He shows up again in Psalms 83, listed as Ishmaelites and Hagarites. He also appears in Jeremiah 41 verse 3. Ishmael appears either indifferent or aggressive aggressive, even having war with Judah. But in the book of Isaiah chapter 6, something has changed. The two oldest sons of Ishmael, Nebaioth and Kedar, are mentioned doing something that one would not expect. Isaiah tells us that Nebaioth's and Kedar's ram will be accepted on Yahweh's altar. Isaiah 60 verse 7, and see also Rashi's comments at kabod.org. The Ishmaelites will be in the Messianic kingdom. If Ishmael is the founder of Islam, that means he should be Jacob's nemesis. So why would God let Ishmael into the kingdom and not Esau, who is set aside for total destruction, according to Obadiah? This is because Esau is Jacob's nemesis, not Ishmael. Ishmael is a participant, but not the instigator. Esau hid himself behind Ishmael to orchestrate the founding of Islam and use it for his end times purposes. We have seen how Esau hid his identity in the four beasts of Daniel. He also hid among the Ishmaelites by marrying Ishmael's daughters Mahalat and Bashemat, according to Genesis 25:17 and chapter 36 verse 3. And being the bully that he is, Esau then usurped Ishmael's house to become the patriarch of Ishmael's family. How do we know this? The Bible tells us about the house of Esau, but there is no mention of a house of Ishmael. The Bible mentions the houses of many other people, important and unimportant, both men and women, but there is no mention of the house of the important son of Abraham, Ishmael, after Esau marries into the family. Esau hid himself among the Ishmaelites, letting them get the credit for being the face of Islam. That phrase, the face of Islam, which is used by the rabbis, suggests that the rabbis know who is behind Ishmael. Even though Esau is hiding behind Ishmael's Islamic robe, we know he is there behind the scenes, working like a puppet master of Ishmael on the strings, and he is ever ready to strike. Ishmael's behavior toward the children of Israel has been more favorable than Esau's. The Ishmaelites gave the children of Israel no trouble in Numbers 20 verse 1 in the desert, whereas war for war, Esau does it much more than Ishmael. Another clue about Esau's place in Islam comes from Psalm 83, which lists the nations allied with the Edomites. Psalm 83 verse 5 to 7. Indeed, they shrewdly planned together, forming an alliance against you, the tents of Edom, the Ishmaelites, Moab, the Hagrites, Gebal, Ammon, Amalek, Philistia, and the inhabitants of Tyre. All the nations listed are now Muslim. The first nation listed are the Edomites, which implies that there is an Edomite leadership in Islam. The last war between Judah and Edom resulted in the forced conversion of all the Edomite males from Mount Seir. Hyrcanus conquered the whole of Idumea and undertook forced conversion of its inhabitants to Judah, according to Josephus in the Antiquities. This suggests that there were no Edomites around at the time of the creation of Islam, but Esau is Rome, and Rome was involved in the creation of Islam. Furthermore, though Hyrcanus converted the remaining Edomites, millions of Esau's descendants had already gone where Jacob went and had mixed in with Jacob. If they mixed with Jacob, might they not have also mixed further into the other Middle Eastern populations? The answer is yes. Esau also married Canaanite, Hivite, and Hittite wives. In trying to establish whether it was Ishmael or Esau who created Islam, let's review some facts about Prophet Muhammad. One glaring physical characteristic gives us a clue about Muhammad's ancestry, because his beard was red. Some say he was a natural redhead like Esau, while others claim he dyed his beard red. It is also said that Muhammad was thick-bearded with a reddish complexion like Esau's. The redness of Muhammad is a clue from God regarding the real founder of Islam. At some point, we must begin to realize that Esau's violent spirit is among us in Judaism, Christianity, and in the secular realm. Most certainly, his spirit is in Islam. Ishmael represents only the face of Islam, but Esau is its power. There is a spirit of Esau that permeates wherever rejection of the Torah abounds. It is this, the rejection of the Torah, that is the signature of the Edomite spirit. Islam rejects the Torah and presents yet another twisted version of God's laws. Wherever we find violence against the Torah and Torah people by those who are part of another beastdom, we have found Esau. What can we expect in the end? The Apostle John's vision included the beast empires of Daniel. Therefore, we can surmise that the next two beast empires after Rome will also be of Edomite origin, either physically, spiritually, or both. Ishmael's role in Islam is better understood in the light of his patriarch Esau. Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon is a description for then and also for now. The two Babylons, the one in Daniel and the end times Babylon, are both beast empires. President Obama fulfilled Esau's red role in turning America from being a vineyard of the Lord to the end times Babylonian type nation. Obama was red in that he aligned himself with the red socialist and communist views. Communism, socialism, fascism are all red. They claim red in their flags and icons. China is known as the Red Dragon, and Russia is also red. Red plays a significant role as a color in Russia. Red Square is a city square in Moscow, and there are other examples of the importance of red in both China and Russia. Esau was red. China and Russia are also red and related to the spirit of Esau and his secular descendant. It now appears that President Donald Trump has picked up the spiritual scepter of King Cyrus and is using it to bring himself fame by forging a heretofore unattainable peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians. Edomite Christian leaders will at some point align with Islam against the true people of Jacob. It may be that Edomites among the Jews will rise up against the true Jews too. Even though Islam will have the military power through Iran, Persia, and the coming king of the north, other Edomites who are scattered with Jacob's descendants will cause chaos among the true believers everywhere. Yeshua warned us of this, so we should expect it. In the end, Islam will kill off the Christian whore too. Why is identifying the founder of Islam important? Correct identification is a requirement when one is about to go to war. We must know who and where our enemy is so that we will know who and where to fight when the time comes. Descendants of Jacob are mixed with Edomites within Islam. God will show them mercy, and so must we. If we don't know our enemy, we will be subject to following our personal idea of who our enemy is rather than God's word. Furthermore, the upcoming war between Esau and Jacob is a conflict of settling injustices, but not the injustices we might think. Esau has not only been unjust, has lied about and lied to Jacob, held Jacob in contempt and attempted to murder him, but also Esau has been unjust to Yahweh. We are taught in the Torah that no he is to treat God like the pagans their God. Esau has done nothing but commit treason against God since the beginning. God requires that justice be done. People treat him treacherously and with contempt. Thus, when we witness God's mighty hand against some Muslims in the end of days, it will behoove us to understand that God is being just in his punishment, because he will be punishing Esau, not Ishmael, not the Jews, or Christians. Esau alone is destined for total annihilation. So let's not pick up this offense against Ishmael and try to annihilate Ishmael along with Esau. Finally, this is important because we must ask ourselves if there is any part of God's book that he does not want to understand. The answer, of course, is no. As his people, we need to know what God put in the Bible to help us in our walk. This includes knowing our true enemy. Christians are not the enemy of the Jews, though at times it has certainly appeared that way. And Jews are not the enemy of Christians, though at times it has appeared that way. The house of Judah and the house of Israel are once again at the crossroads of reunification. Will we make the same mistake that was made 2,000 years ago? Will we keep fighting each other? Or will we finally band together against our true enemy, Esau? That's it for this Beast Watch News update. This is Kimberly Rogers Brown signing off. Click over to BeastWatchNews.com for full comprehensive coverage of all the headlines fulfilling end of days Bible prophecy.